Hey everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. This is your host Miles, and this is Miles on the Grid. In this week's show, we actually have a really special guest, Mr. Bryson Sullivan, an aerospace expert. Can I call you an aerospace expert?
Never. I will never allow it.
and a real student of a Formula One, or I wouldn't even say Formula One, but the motorsport game. So Bryson, welcome to the podcast, and it's a real pleasure to have you.
All right, thank you for having me, Miles. I appreciate being here.
It's awesome. So, I mean, just to give people a bit of context, like you mentioned a couple of moments ago, I've been following you since you had less followers than you do now. Now, for context, Bryson has around 6,500 followers, and he tweets mainly really good things about Lewis Hamilton, which I can appreciate, but also really interesting technical pieces of knowledge. And I know that you also set up or helped to set up a Discord server for all F1 fans, which I think is incredible. Detailing everything from like tech, aero, engines, powertrains, and full work. But would you mind telling my audience a bit more about yourself? That's cool.
Yeah, I think the first way to describe myself is that I'm not normal. Right? That's there are many areas in which I am not a normal person, but I am extremely focused on F1 and I really do enjoy it. I also would very quickly dismiss any description of being an expert in anything. I mean, I think, you know, it's kind of like one of those things, like the more you practice something, the better you get at it, you know, whatever it happens to be, whatever your focus happens to be on. I do really appreciate a lot of the aero things and technical things in general. And even though I'm not necessarily the most extreme or most experienced person in every possible facet of a given, you know, technology domain, a lot of times I have enough exposure to it, enough experience in it to be able to communicate the important bits of it to someone else. And I think that's probably a little bit more useful than I might have originally intended or really should have appreciated.
No, but
I do appreciate all of the energy in the F1 community and the hunger for information. So if I can help communicate that at all, I'm more than happy to do it.
So, I mean, with that in mind, how did you get started, or where did the knowledge of aerodynamics in particular, or let's say like even wider tech, come from? Because I can read as many books as I want to, but you seem to have a knack for, like you mentioned, explaining the technical in a simple way.
I mean, I have engineering background in my family, and I have, you know, it's mostly on the aviation side, really.
Nice.
My dad was an engineer and he's a pilot, and I definitely learned a lot of cool things about aerodynamics and, you know, aviation from him. I think what actually ended up happening was, you know, growing up, I grew up kind of in South Florida, surrounded by very cool cars and fast cars and motorcycles. I was very into the racing kind of scene, if that makes sense. not so much in motorsport, but just in, you know, fast cars and things.
Yes.
And I was focused on that early on, and I think what ended up happening was in my undergraduate, when I had my first course in fluid mechanics, and then especially my first course in aerodynamics, as I was studying mechanical engineering, it really kind of changed my perception of things. Because if you haven't studied aerodynamics before and you look at it, it's actually like a very different, the theory for it is actually very different than you might expect. And I kind of caught my eye. Okay. And kind of drew me into that whole part of things. And then basically when I started doing graduate school, I switched to aerospace engineering just because of that. I really enjoyed doing it, and it gave me a chance to do more fluids and aero work. But yeah, as far as, you know, how that started, it's just a natural progression of things that I find interesting. Regarding the F1 side of it, honestly, it's kind of an accident.
Fair enough.
I mean, really, I mean that in total honesty, because you know, my first exposure to real motorsports, like at all, was going to a Formula One race in person, right?
Okay.
And I was kind of dragged. I was dragged to the race by my friends telling me, "You have to go." I'm like, "Why would I? Why would I waste my Sunday watching cars go in circles? That's so silly. Why would I do that?"
Yeah.
But then I actually went. And you know, I think what people don't realize is, yes, we have race cars. Race cars are extremely fast, but F1 is a completely different level.
Yes, like,
F1 cars are literally the fastest cars. They're actually the fastest vehicles that you can send around a racetrack at any given time. You could put a rocket on a sled and have it go around certain parts of the track, but it couldn't turn. And it wouldn't be able to brake. I mean, literally, the fastest vehicle that can go around a racetrack is a Formula One car. The performance of these vehicles is extraordinary, and I just like learning about them and then talking about them. And I think this sport is unique because it is a circus, really. There's the technological element that I really like, but then there's the driver element. Yes. You have these, the LeBron James and Tiger Woods of their respective sports, but yeah, they're working with machines, right? There's nothing else that's like that. You could, even if you had like a fighter pilot, you know, flying an F-22, we're not racing F-22s, yeah. Right? Like it's a completely different enterprise. I think that makes it really unique, and that's why I like talking about it.
And I think that's fascinating that you mentioned that they are technically the fastest, I'd say at least like land machines that you can get, and then you get into the intricate side of what compromises a great driver, what constitutes a great driver, what constitutes a great driver package, and how does the driver extract, let's say, like the maximum from their car or their vehicle. I'm thinking with that in mind, how do you see aero, or not how do you see, I'll rephrase the question. We know that aero has a massive part to play in F1. What is your favorite part of aerodynamics within the F1 community?
All of it. Really, just all of it. just give me all of it.
Sure.
You know, if we're talking about drag, you know, we're talking about the aerodynamic weight coming off the cars. If we're talking about the front to back load distribution of downforce, because that makes a big impact on the balance. Yes. It even comes into play with something I think seemingly unrelated, which is like cooling. You think about the cooling flow that you have, you know, how fast your car could be oftentimes is depending on how hard you can run your engine.
Yes.
Well, how hard you can run your engine depends on how much you can cool it, and how much you can cool it directly impacts how much drag the car has, which impacts how fast it is.
Yeah.
Right? So it's like, I want the car to go faster, but the only way to do that is to make the engine run harder, but I have to reduce speed to make it run harder. And it is the definition of a multidisciplinary problem. And I think the thing that's really interesting about F1 is it's really an arms race. It's a technological arms race where not only are the teams fighting each other in a way to exploit regulations and loopholes in a way that benefits their team, but year on year, the regulations are changing.
Yes.
Right. So you have to make modifications to your own design only in respect to the regulation changes. So it's actually not just team versus team, but it's all the teams versus the FIA and the regulatory body trying to figure out something that is, you know, suitably safe. It's not totally crazy, but also, you know, maintains the inherent spirit of Formula One, the speed and the moniker of being the fastest racing series that there is. I mean, no matter what changes we make to F1, at any given point in time, it will always be the fastest racing series that exists. And I think that's a very special privilege it has.
And I think it's interesting you mentioned that, because I know that there is a case for IndyCar drivers to, I'm not going to get into it, but I've had a few chats with people who are friends or fans of Indy, like I am, but more F1, who believe that Indy is actually a more technological sport than F1, because all the cars are spec to a degree, and there is a greater involvement of driver skill, and aero works differently.
Just to be clear, I'm sympathetic to the idea that the racing can be better in IndyCar. I'm sympathetic to the idea that the absolute measure of a driver's ability is better in a spec series. Now, granted, car setup is a big deal, right? Cool. And even if the car is the same specification, you can make seconds of lap time just based entirely on setup. So even then, the car is going to matter. But there's a kind of a conflict at the heart of Formula One, which is, you cannot have a spec series and simultaneously be the most bleeding edge, you know, cutting edge, technologically advanced sport in the world. And you're going to have to sacrifice the racing at least a little bit in order to achieve that. Now, F1 as a whole understands this, and they want to give us more racing when we can. So that's why the regulations coming up in the future are explicitly designed not only to maximize like the car performance, but actually the interaction of cars. They're doing a lot of, you know, two-body car simulations it's a little bit harder to do two cars in the wind tunnel because the wind tunnels aren't big enough.
Yes.
and honestly, to get the separation that you want to really do the studies for the drag reduction, there just aren't wind tunnels big enough, and making the car small enough to make the distance kind of matter causes other problems with the Reynolds number, which is an aerodynamic thing. So it's difficult, but I think that we're at a point now where everyone understands what we want, and yes, I think we're on the right path to get there.
So I mean, with the view to closer racing, let's say from like 2022, we've heard it on countless weekends for the past 20 weekends or 21 weekends. And after a while, it does get boring to hear it. But we saw the reveal of the new cars, what the prototype car would be for F1 in 2022 back in July. What were your thoughts around how Aero has been redesigned? Because we saw regulations which should have been in 2020 come into effect in 2021, which changed the way that low-rate teams could set up their car versus high-rate teams. What's your view?
So the first thing I would say, I'll talk about 2021 first and then 2022.
Sure.
You know, aerodynamics is such a non-linear thing. Just small, tiny changes in something that seem totally superficial that the average person wouldn't even observe have massive impacts on the running order of the teams and ultimate lap time.
Yes.
You know, if I were to show people, you know, a 2021 floor, like rear part of the floor with the back cut out, or a 2020 floor, they would say that looks the same. I don't even see any difference. Mm. They don't see anything about, you know, fully enclosed holes and, you know, stepped floors and all that other things. And the Z cut out
yeah.
but it makes massive differences to lap time. And depending on if your car is a longer wheelbase or a shorter wheelbase, and of course you mentioned how the rake is, it has a huge difference. So I think that just to start off with, let's just appreciate how sensitive these designs are to small changes. Mm-hmm. Even the deflection of the tire wall in cornering has a big impact on sealing the diffuser and all kinds of stuff. It's very complicated. With respect to 2022, I think Formula One may have actually done itself a slight disservice in constructing a full-scale model of a 2022 car. And the reason is because that car is F1's notional representation of what their interpretation of the regulations could potentially be, meeting their objectives, which are, you know, drag reduction, you know, a reduction of the turbulent wake coming off the car in front, and a reduction in sensitivity of the car behind to that wake. Fine. Yes. The teams have different objectives, and they're self-interested, those objectives. So the cars that we actually see are going to be similar to that car, but I think by building it and showing it to everyone, you may be giving people a false impression of what they might actually see and what the teams actually came up with.
Yeah.
And also some people were confused about, well, is F1 a spec series now?
Yeah.
Right? Like they were showing that car and everyone's like, well, that's the car for next year. Isn't, doesn't that mean it was a spec series? And it really isn't. Yeah. There are a lot of differences between the cars, not just on the pure aerodynamic side, but kind of like from a vehicle dynamic side, you know, massive changes with these new wheels, these new 18-inch wheels and the low profile tires associated with them. Have a huge difference in the way the car turns in and in tire performance characteristics.
Yeah.
Not only that, but changing the amount of downforce that we're making with the floor as opposed to the rear wings or front wings has a huge difference on the aero balance of the car. It's just gonna drive differently. Yeah. Even if it's originally slower, and I think it will be slightly slower, the drivers are going to have to completely reinvent the way that they drive these cars. And they're going to be unlike anything else they've ever driven before. The good news is everything that I've seen about the 2022 design, both in its intent and the way it's actually being implemented, tells me this is going to work. You're definitely going to have less high speed understeer or the car, you know, pushing wide behind the other car in a high speed corner. You're definitely going to have less of that. I don't think it's going to be as dramatic as the numbers that they're quoting, but at the same time, I don't think it has to be that dramatic to really improve the racing. So when I say quote unquote improve the racing, we've had an amazing season this year already. And I think one of the reasons why the racing has been so good is because whenever there's a regulation change, it's kind of like a big jump in performance.
Yes.
And some teams get it right, you know, some teams don't. Eventually, there's convergence on design philosophy, and all teams kind of get things together. Then it becomes more marginal things that put one team ahead of another. This is Mercedes' least dominant year in the turbo hybrid era, like very obviously in a big way. But if you look on average, you know, what was the average, you know, gap over their competitors in qualifying, for example, you know, every year, you know, 2014, you know, 16, 17, it's gone back and forth a little bit, but it's gradually been getting slower anyway.
Yeah.
Right. So even though I think what you kind of get is as the relentless push of development happens on the technological side, what you see is all the cars getting faster in overall pace, and then the gaps between the fastest cars going down. And I think it makes sense to modify that here and there. But I think the new change that we're going to get for 2022, it will shake up the order. I don't think the Haas is going to be dominating the field. I don't think it's going to be quite that extreme.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I do think we're going to have some surprises. My personal picks for surprises are going to be Ferrari. Ooh. And after Qatar, I'm going to say Alpine. I'm going to say maybe Alpine has a trick up their sleeve, and Fernando, you know, clearly has used 2021 as, it was always kind of intended as like a warm-up season.
Yes.
It was a season to like get back into Formula One and get a feel for how these cars drive. And he's definitely been a lot better in the second half of the year than he was very, very early on. So I'm looking forward to it.
See, my picks, it's interesting you mentioned Alpine after today's result, or at least the qualifying, for example. My picks were Ferrari, as well as hopefully Williams. And I say Williams just from Jos Capital's influence, as well as the new investment from the venture capitalists. However, I can't seem to count Mercedes up. I can't.
Yeah.
For some reason, James Allison is just pushing that team to different levels when it comes to the boundaries of both aero as well as engine performance.
And again, so James Allison is one of my favorite guys in Formula One. You know, he is endlessly easy to listen to and explains things well. But he, by his own admission, he hasn't designed a part in years, right? He hasn't personally designed a part in a long time. But I think the ethos that he creates in the team and the way that he organizes people on the technical side, it benefits everyone collectively to be on the same page and to kind of understand where we're going. And I also won't count out Mercedes because remember the entire reason why they shifted their focus away from 2021, and the thing that's partially making this championship so tight, is explicit focus on 2022. So as incredible as the progress that Red Bull has made, and how much progress Honda has made, and the way in which they've gotten so level on pace and better on pace in most cases than Mercedes. All of that is in the context of Mercedes not actually throwing everything at this championship. They are throwing everything at it in terms of engines. I agree at that, but they're not throwing everything at it in terms of aero development.
No,
right?
Absolutely not.
So I completely agree with your assessment that Mercedes is going to be strong next year. And I think it would be wrong to assume that George Russell is not going to be strong as well next year. I think people have this conception of, well, whoever joins, you know, Mercedes with Lewis Hamilton is a number two by definition.
No.
And in a sense, that's true. But what you have to understand is George isn't actually a number two.
Yeah.
He's actually a number one in training.
Yes. Yeah, this is right? The thing.
But what he actually is the person that Mercedes believes is their number one of the future when Lewis retires. And that's not my opinion. That's a fact.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the key factor with George is that he was immediately handed a multi-year contract right away, like immediately.
Yeah.
Valtteri was struggling with single-year contracts his entire Mercedes career. And he's mentioned in the past that it's been difficult for him because of that. So right away, Mercedes is telling us that George Russell is going to be given a fair shot against Lewis Hamilton. If you can beat Lewis Hamilton, you know, more power to you.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, like, he's not easy to beat. You know, ask literally anyone who's gone up against him. So I'm looking forward to next year.
I would say ask anyone, apart from maybe Nico Rosberg, just for the pure fact that Rosberg holds that championship as some sort of weighted title. That being said, I do love the way that Rosberg went around about his business, so I have to give him...
Rosberg is very, very good.
Yeah.
Okay, I think he's a lot better than people give him credit for.
Yeah.
At the same time, only he understands the tax, the mental drain that was required to fight Lewis Hamilton tooth and nail to a championship and win.
Yeah.
The fact that he retired immediately and everyone was surprised, but Lewis was not surprised, tells you everything I think you need to know about that particular saga. Brosades.
And I mean, just switching the conversation from Aero to title protagonists and the season that we're having, in part caused by Mercedes' focus on 2022, but also the gains that Honda and Red Bull powertrains have made, that you mentioned. Not Red Bull powertrains, not yet anyway. I don't want to say who's your money on, because obviously you're a Lewis Hamilton fan and that's fantastic, but where do you see the championship potentially being decided between either Lewis or Max?
So here's what I would say about that. I do, you know, rep Mercedes and Lewis Hamilton in some meaningful way. That's definitely true.
Yeah.
But I was a fan of Formula One before either of them really rose to prominence.
Yeah.
The race that I mentioned to you before, that was my first exposure to Formula One, was the 2005 US Grand Prix, actually. Right?
Nice.
A race that was famous for being, you know, one of the worst ever, presumably because there's only six cars on the track and it was an insane weekend. But the performance of the cars stood out. They stood out to me right away. I could tell immediately that there was something crazy going on there, and I've been hooked kind of ever since.
Yeah.
So I'm a fan of Formula One, like, writ large, before I'm a fan of Mercedes or Lewis Hamilton. That being said, they are my favorites. Not only that, I think they are incredibly well positioned to take at least one of those championships. Bottas's day today at Qatar did not help.
No.
I
saw your tweet.
I was the first one to say this was not going well. You have to do something. And Valtteri came back fighting. He was just scything his way through the field. That was just like, come on, Valtteri, you can do this.
Yeah.
And he just got really unlucky, I would say, with the puncture. I mean, maybe he was riding the curbs a little bit, but I didn't really watch his entire race on board. That's a big blow for Mercedes to win the constructors. It's not impossible, and they're still leading. I think they're still leading the constructors, but
yes,
it puts it in the range of jeopardy that cannot be ignored.
Yeah.
Regarding Lewis, what's he been eating? What's he been eating recently? I wouldn't bet against Lewis Hamilton in the worst of times, but he's actually on song right now.
Yeah.
I think ever since he touched the ground in Brazil, really, he's been unstoppable. He's been, you know, and I can tell you that everyone's saying, oh, this engine is crazy. It's giving him 8/10 and just all of these insane things.
No,
and I'm like, you cannot deny something is going on where we say that the closer a championship gets, the better Lewis becomes.
Yes.
That's always been true, but normally he can push hard enough to wrap it up kind of early or come close to it.
Yeah.
Right now he's in the thick of it. You're literally showing you're putting a championship trophy in front of his face and telling him not to touch it, not to grab it. And he doesn't know how to do that. But you put it, he's gonna try to grab it. So I think that he's been really incredible. As I said before, Mercedes has given them the package to at least be able to fight. Like, you can give him a chance to fight, he will wipe the floor with almost anyone, especially if it's coming down to the wire.
Yeah.
I think it's really telling that this track, which has a lot of medium to high speed corners in it, something that should suit the Red Bull, Mercedes was still able to be ahead comfortably. At least Lewis was. Not only that, but he wasn't even using the Brazil power unit.
So I wanted to touch on this because for me at Tur I think Christian Horner was mentioning on the post race after he came back from the stewards, ironically, that Mercedes were a lot quicker in turn six, which ideally should have been a Red Bull corner. And I hate Red Bull track versus Mercedes track, but just given that their car suits a medium to high speed corner a lot better. But Lewis was just flying and he kept on pushing. I think it was like 2 tenths every single lap of that particular corner.
It's on the entry as well. He's carrying a lot of speed on the entry and still making the apex. So I was kind of like they were kind of similar on the exits. I think the exits were very similar, but he just had the grip to send it in really hard. And I also noticed this after watching practice and then qualifying,
Yes.
looking through that long series of right-handers, you know, it's this turn 12, 13, and 14, kind of like Turkey turn eight. Although, you know, turn eight's one corner, but
It
this is
feels like
three
three.
corners. You know, we don't ever question the circuit numbering. It just tells what it is, we move on. But almost every driver, you know, the first and second apex were, you know, easily flat in seventh gear, no issues. But normally by a third apex, they're kind of on the limit in terms of cornering and steering lock. And most drivers have a confidence kind of downshift. They'll downshift to sixth gear. And Lewis was just rolling through there in seventh, you know, he, rolling through there in seventh and rolling through turn 15 in seventh, the left-hander as well, you know, flat. You know, because we have people that do really good telemetry work. And we don't have to just go off of engine note. We can actually look at the throttle traces and yeah, he's flat. So I'm just like, this is why this is such an incredible sport. You can build the fastest car that you want, but it takes a human element, the human factor to extract every possible tenth at it. I can assure you in mathematical terms, Lewis was probably, you know, it's like a subtle push, like a gust of wind could have pushed him over the edge in terms
Absolutely.
of traction, in terms of how close he was to the limit. You know, if you could instantaneously stop the car in its dynamic condition and just like push it a little bit, I'm sure a little nudge would have thrown it offline. But it takes that driver skill, that ability to understand in your mind what the car can actually do, and then have frankly, the balls to actually do it in a high speed corner where when you have the risk to go off, that's where the skill really comes in. And I think that's where Lewis is really incredible. He has an ability to find pace in the car in a way that it's almost like it doesn't want to do it, but when he drives it, he's like he coaxes it into performance. That is a really impressive thing.
And I mean, I'm just looking at the time because I don't want to keep people for too long, but
No, that's fine.
If you think back to all of, and I'm not just going to say Lewis, but any driver who's won a championship in the last, let's say, like 15, 20 years, who would you say has had the most impressive performance of that particular year or championship winning year, according to that? So, like, let's say, like, going back to 2005.
No, it's got to be Fernando. You know, Fernando, you know, the reason why Fernando was so beloved and so cherished by so many fans, not necessarily me, but I understand it. Like everyone was so happy for him today, is because of the way the talent that he demonstrated in 2005 and 2006. You know, going head to head with Michael Schumacher in a Ferrari, mind you, was something that hadn't been done in half a decade. You know, longer. So people were just trying to understand who is this kid, you know, someone from a country who, you know, hadn't really produced a huge number of incredibly successful F1 drivers. They definitely had, you know, rally drivers and some other drivers as well. But in F1, you know, Fernando was doing things that were kind of unbelievable. So I think, you know, without question for me, you know, Fernando was the class of the field in 2005 and 2006. They did have some technological advantages with a certain J damper that may or a mass inerter, which may or may not have helped them in the starts. And I also may have been lucky enough to meet with Malcolm Smith and talk to him about that a few years ago.
Oh, nice.
He's the inventor of J damper and kind of how it works. But he did an incredible job. and Reno did an incredible job. So I think they're the class of the field. 2007 is just Lewis. I think he didn't win the championship that year, but he was leading it. You can never count out someone when you think someone's going to win. Yeah. Even if you think Max Verstappen was like ahead by, you know, what was it, 12 points and five races to go or whatever it was, that's nothing.
Yeah.
That you can go through that incredibly easily. And China 2007 was one of the most painful things I've ever experienced as a fan. Right. Yes. Like I can imagine for the Brazilian fans that Brazil 2008 was extremely painful for them.
Yeah.
But for me personally, China 2007 was like the thing. That was my introduction to Formula One, really. Like I'd been interested in it before, but never really been invested in a driver. Yeah. And I always tell people, you know, if you've never had your heart ripped out watching this sport, you haven't been watching long enough. Mm. You haven't been watching long enough. So for Lewis to be a rookie, someone who was highly regarded and yes. one of the best, you know, pre-F1 careers of anyone, yeah. but was still expected to be, you know, washed by Fernando Alonso. For him to be as competitive as he was from race one, lap one, corner one,
yeah.
just
yeah,
ready,
yeah.
ready to go.
Australia.
You know, he was just ready to go, ready to fight, and not taking anything from Fernando. His fight with Fernando at Indianapolis, you know, side by side down yeah. the main straight, not being, you know, spooked off of the line. He just showed incredible composure. He showed incredible skill. I was actually there at the race in 2007,
oh, nice.
Which was a really amazing, amazing time. And I was like trying to understand, like, if he could do this in his first year, like what could he have to accomplish? And even I don't think I was psychologically prepared to allow myself to even think about something like 100 pole positions,
yes,
100 wins. You know, those are video game numbers.
Yeah,
really. Those
they don't happen.
Those are crazy. He, you know, he is a centurion, and it's a representation of not just talent, but talent realized. You know, talent actually delivered upon for a very long amount of time. We could go on to some of the other years as well, but yeah, I think those are the ones I would start off with. And I'm going to lose a little bit in 2011, 2012.
No, of course.
Those are a little bit tough, but early on, those were the ones. And I do enjoy those conversations because they always invite questions of who's the best driver ever, right? Who could Max Verstappen beat Lewis Hamilton and all those other things? It's a little bit naive to think that we could settle that just by discussing it.
Yeah.
Not only because there are different drivers that have different peaks. Lewis doesn't have a peak. He just comes up as like a plateau and just stays at a high level. But I can imagine, you know, Lewis Hamilton in 2007 is a very different driver to go up against than Lewis Hamilton in 2021.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to imagine, you know, Max Verstappen of the current time going up against that Lewis Hamilton. That would be an amazing thing to do. But also, because this is such a technological sport, the cars evolution themselves has completely changed. Yeah. The cars they're driving are completely changed. I mean, you know, Senna and Schumacher, a lot of their careers drove with traction control
yeah.
things and electronic aids. We don't have now, right? Yeah. Senna drove with H gearboxes. You know, he would love to you know, change gear in the middle of, you know, 130R.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but the man can't because he's got like one hand on the wheel and another one on the gearbox. But you can do these things now if you wanted to. So I think it will always be a hard question to define who's the best of all time for anything. Mm-hmm. You can certainly argue who's the best of your era, who's the best of your generation, and, you know, without any question for me, Lewis is the one. He clearly has done everything that he needs to do on track to demonstrate superiority.
Yeah,
and I also think that his willingness to not let that define him, his willingness to have, you know, extracurricular activities that are more than just random things. I mean, they're actually important things. I think that sets him apart from really any other driver for me.
I think I'll have to agree with you on that one. Not just from the perspective of Lewis, because we had the amazing Vettel years. We had Alonso 2006, 2005. We had Schumacher 2004, which I think for me was my favorite season, just because it's the one I can remember the first. Lewis's year in 2012 broke. That was the year that broke my heart. Oh wait, 07 didn't break my heart. I was hopeful, but it wasn't there. But 2012, when Lewis really should have clinched the title,
he could have done it. I think we know enough now. We can go back and look at the details that I've seen enough personally.
Yeah.
I've seen enough evidence personally to believe that he could have done it. In a way, I'm glad he didn't, though, because that the strategic blunders, the other details, and the power unit side and things pushed him to try something new.
Yes.
It pushed him to try to emulate Michael. Michael was known. The thing Michael is most famous for, besides all the fitness and testing things he was amazing for kind of defining, he's most known for taking Ferrari to championship status again.
Yeah.
Taking a team that was not ready to win a championship and dragging them by the scruff of the neck, seemingly, into incredible form. And they were just, so dominant in those years. I think Lewis understood that that was kind of a unique thing. And he wanted to emulate that. He looked up to Michael and still does look up to Michael in many ways. I think he wanted to carve that bit of a story out for himself, and he's done it. It's amazing when people see how successful he's been since then, and to go back and look at that interview that he gave to Jeremy Clarkson in 2013
on Top Gear,
Jeremy is like, what are you doing, mate? Like, you're going to a midfield pack at best. They've got one victory in their entire career since they came back to Formula One. Have you made a great mistake? And Lewis was like, I think I'm up for a challenge. I think it'll be fun. It sounds silly now, but you can go back and look at the articles that are written there. People said he's got no chance of winning the championship. So I think that he's written an incredible story. They wouldn't even be able to make a movie about Lewis Hamilton. You'd need a trilogy. You would need three or four feature length films to really get a handle on describing his story, because he's kind of a unique figure in history.
I think there's never going to be another, like, okay, I have to backpedal from that one in case. but in this current era, I don't see there being another driver like him. In terms of what he's been able to accomplish. But then again, my dad said the same thing about Michael. So I might just have to eat my words on that one.
Well, the good news is the level of performance and the standard is set so high now that you actually need to look, when someone comes in, they have to start winning almost immediately.
Yeah.
To even start having a chance. I think Max does still have a chance, because even though he didn't start winning immediately, he joined like incredibly young. I think he was like 17 when he started. And we've seen Alonso getting podiums. How old is he, like 50? Like, what? This man has been, he has been around for a while, and he's still got it where it counts. So I imagine, a driver like Max probably could have a good shot at coming close if Red Bull happened to go across an era of dominance similar to what Lewis and Mercedes has done. I'm not sure how likely that is, but it could happen. I think the best way to think about this is someone is going to break a record at some point.
Yes.
That's fine. But all that does is just bring back the conversation of, well, look where the record is. Like, look what the standard is. Let's just take a second to appreciate what an outrageous career this person has had. And, we've been lucky that safety has been improving Formula One a lot.
Absolutely.
It didn't used to be that way. There were many, many drivers who were incredibly talented.
Yeah.
Who either, suffered career-ending injuries and crashes, or sadly lost their lives.
Yeah.
I think all of us were robbed of an incredible career that Ayrton Senna could have had. I don't think there's any question that he's in the conversation for one of the best ever.
Yeah.
And could have been if he just had a little bit more opportunity to see him drive.
I agree. And I know we're according to the Zoom call, we're running out of time, but just quickly, I think mentioning furthering what you just mentioned, Jim Clark, Ascari, Fangio, if he could have continued. Oh,
Fangio was a beast. Fangio was an absolute monster. We looked at winning percentage before the analysis of winning percentage, not just like overall, but winning percentages of races that he finished.
Yeah.
Fangio was mad.
It's crazy. Fangio had
incredible numbers.
And when you've got drivers, I'm trying to think of someone on Robert Kubica, for example, who had the speed to match Lewis in many occasions, I think. Other drivers who didn't necessarily get their shot or didn't take their shot in F1, Pablo Montoya, Nick Heidfeld. And Nick Heidfeld had the car until BMW stopped developing it. So,
yeah.
Like, I think you're right in saying that we can't say that no one's going to eclipse what Lewis has done, because it just sets the benchmark for the future. But I'm hopeful it stays for at least 10 years, like how Michael did.
It will stay for a long time. But if you remember, it's almost like there always has to be someone crazy that enters the sport at a given time.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael came back after his first retirement, but
yes.
You know, what year did Michael retire the first time? It was 2006.
Yeah.
And we were like, well, that's the end of an era. And immediately, the very next year, is Lewis Hamilton's worst year. So it's like conservation of greatness. Something is going on where somebody great has to always be there. I imagine a lot of these records will be broken eventually, but, you know, good luck. That's all I have to say about that.
I'm just thinking, bonus question. And this could be off a record or on the record. So which one would you prefer?
I don't have any problems with on the record.
Oh, okay, cool. Just in case you have any ties to any manufacturers or divisions. But what would you say is your favorite F1 car of all time?
Oh, man. So here's the thing. I love a lot of different cars for different reasons. Yeah. They express themselves in different ways. Sometimes you have a car that seemingly doesn't look exactly the way that you would think it needs to look, but it's exactly that way for a reason, and there's lap time to be gained in it. Certainly the first car I ever loved was the MP420.
Okay, yeah.
The 2005 era, yeah. McLaren, and, you know, watching Kimi drive it was pretty amazing. There will always be a nostalgic affinity for, you know, the MP423.
Okay.
And the history that car has with Lewis and the championships, and, you know, and it just looked crazy. You know, it was one of the last years before the 2009 sort of crackdown on louvers and radiator chimneys and crazy other things, and, you know, the horns and, you know, the elephant ears, all these things that the cars used to have. They just made them look insane. So I do like that car. But the truth is, my favorite car is probably actually the W11.
Ooh, here. Perfect answer.
it's the livery, the way it looks and what it means, and the performance of that car was phenomenal. I remember watching qualifying laps at Belgium.
Yes.
At Spa. Yeah. And I saw Lewis, you know, I was looking at the onboards and I was like, did you just take Pujon flat?
Yeah.
I said, did you take Pujon flat? But you're insane. And to be clear, I'm aware of a story of Fernando Alonso taking Pujon flat in a Honda powered McLaren that one time in 2015 or whatever it was, or maybe it was 17. I remember him doing that, but I'll tell you what, he was not doing 370 kilometers per hour. I'll tell you that, 3 kilometers per hour. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah.
He was taking it flat, and that was ballsy. I give him that. But he was not going anywhere near as fast as Lewis was. The direction change of that car, the outright speed of it, it was just, you know, one of the most amazing things I'd ever seen in terms of the performance that the car had in it inherently.
Yes.
But also Lewis's ability to really extract it out of it, to drag the performance out of it. So that will always be the most iconic Formula One car for me that I love. But I certainly have a lot of appreciation for many others. I do like the 2005, 2006 era, you know, Renaults, you know, R25, R26 Renaults.
Yeah.
The Model 7 livery is iconic. No one is going to argue that. I do love the old Ferraris as well. You know, the glossy paint they used to have, it was great, that we don't use anymore because it weighs too much. But I did really like those old era Ferraris as well. So I think there have been a lot of iconic cars over time, and I'm sure there will be others in the future. And again, we have this idea of what 2022 is going to be.
Yes.
But I don't think we really understand what a fully fledged design looks like. even that model that was released at Silverstone by F1, that's like preliminary design that they built. There's all kinds of details in in the wheel covers, in the floor, in the Venturi tunnels, in the front wing design, in the distribution of load across the span. There's infinite details that F1 did not do, that the F1 teams are going to do in the course of building their cars, that will actually make the final result. And I think they're going to look a lot better than people give it credit for.
Well, here I am praying that the W13.
No. They can't name it the W13. 13 is unlucky. They have to skip it and call it the 12B. They can't call it the 13. But I am looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm just praying it gets better. But on the topic of favorite car, I think mine has to be the F2004. Mm. Just from what it stood for at the time, like 7 championships. I remember getting my first Top Gear magazine, and Michael's face was there, and he was just sitting on the cars like, what is that? But like you mentioned, from a performance perspective, the W11, the way that it went through Brooks and Copse and Silverstone, like you mentioned, the change of direction, I didn't expect it to hold or to stick. So much so that when I started playing on F1 2020, I was like, why is it not working the same way for me? Obviously, I'm not Lewis Hamilton with a joystick or Jarno Ockmann, but it was a legendary feat. I'm not going to get into the nicknames for the W12, lest I get sued by admin or anyone else.
No, I personally have been in contact with people that are either currently or formerly affiliated with Mercedes, and I think everyone agrees that it's not the beast that they were all hoping it would be. So don't worry about it.
Oh, cool. But apart from that, those are my questions. I mean, do you have anything that you wanted to just either shout out to the audience or discuss briefly?
You know, I think what I would say to people is I'm glad that they're here. I'm glad that they're interested in this sport that is totally unique among other things, and both from the terms of sports and entertainment, but also in terms of like technological things.
Yes.
Even aircraft. High performance aircraft that can fly several times the speed of sound. It's a totally different kind of aero. Mm. Really, it's totally different. There's nothing that's quite the same as Formula One, and there's nothing that kind of has the power to inspire in quite the same way that F1 does. I think other things have their own beauty to them, but I think we almost elevate some of our drivers to kind of like hero and like legendary status. F1 has the power to do that in a way that some things sometimes otherwise don't. So all I would say is keep enjoying it, keep having fun, and if I can help explain some things occasionally, I will. I have written a couple of articles, but I do want to be writing more when the time comes, and trying to do what I can to get people engaged. So I'm looking forward to it.
Nice. And thank you so much for not only your time today, but all of your help explaining stuff on Twitter. Everyone, if you haven't followed Bryson Sullivan, please go on Twitter and go to Natural Paradigm. I cannot express this enough just due to the depth of this gentleman's knowledge. But Bryson, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the podcast. I'd be more than happy to have you on again in the future, and I'm sure we'd probably come up with a whole new host of topics to get stuck into.
Thanks for having me.
But no, it's been a real pleasure, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of the evening. All right.